Hi, good morning, and happy Sunday, Calvary. My name is Marianne Katz, and I am blessed with the privilege and the honor of being able to participate in the women's ministry and the Calvary Kids ministry and the reading team up here. So, and just in case, I don't get a lot of chocolate for Christmas, so that's my name tag today, okay? Anyway, our reading today is from Isaiah, chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. Please follow along as I read. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he was made glorious, the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of darkness, of deep darkness, on them has light shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the trampling warrior in the battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, and to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this.
Thanks, Marianne. Well, as we said at the beginning of service this morning, that today marks the start of Advent. Now, Advent is a really important, a really special moment in the church calendar that Christians have been celebrating for as long back as we can see as the 4th century or so, where it's this time that we focus on the coming of Jesus. That's what that word means in a really simple definition. Advent means coming or arrival. We celebrate that Jesus has come. He was born on Christmas. And yet it's also a time that we are awaiting his second advent, when he comes back. So Advent then becomes this interesting time that's marked by the joy of what Jesus has accomplished. Yet it's the waiting, the longing, the anticipation of what he will do when he comes back. We are in a privileged position to be able to say on this side of the cross what Jesus has already accomplished. That is our certainty. That is what gives us the hope to look forward. But it is still a time that we await when he fully keeps all of his promises. It's a time of waiting and rejoicing. It's important as well that we set aside this time to be different, to be distinct, because it's easy for us to miss the significance of this season. It's easy for us to get swept up in all else that comes when December does. And many of these things are not going to be bad things. We fill our time with family and traditions and joy and all of these gatherings that we do. Those are good. We would never say those are bad. But it's easy when our calendar becomes full to miss the importance of this time. It's easy as there's so many pressures around us that we miss what is truly valuable in this moment. It's easy as our calendars get out of whack that begins to fill our mind with the importance of this time instead. It's a moment that's full of directions that we can get pulled, full of messaging as to what is the significance of the season, and we want to stop. We want to pause and remember the reason we have for joy and the reason why we are waiting. It makes me think of when my wife and I were pregnant with our child, one of us more than the other. And it was this time that was full of anticipation, of waiting, of joy. That even before we saw him face to face, there was this delight, this desire to see what will he be like? Who will he become? It's building this joy in the anticipation of who he will be. And during that time, what adds to it is this question that we got peppered with throughout is, what will his name be? What will you call him? And so it's this time to build anticipation, to build joy as we are waiting to be able to see him face to face. As what will we call him becomes this question we're asking. It makes me think of the situation that was going on in the book of Isaiah. It's a weird transition, I know, but just stick with me. Because in the book of Isaiah, it's written at a time to where God's people were waiting. The anticipation was building. And as we talk about how we now are waiting for Jesus to come back, well, it's easy to find a parallel to the time that the world was waiting before Jesus came the first time. There's this longing of, when will God keep his promises? This waiting for, when will things turn out the way God says they will be? Much like we ask today. And so it's easy to go to these places towards the end of the Old Testament and see, well, there's friends, there's peers. They too were waiting like we were. But the book of Isaiah in particular makes me think of this, because the first 9 to 10 chapters or so, well, the way the story is told is through the promise of sons and the unique names that they were given. God is working through the lives of his people, and he continues to say that these sons will be given, and they're given unique names as ways to show the work that God is doing. Now, let me give some context to the book of Isaiah so we can understand why this matters, why this is significant. The story comes after centuries of God being faithful to the Jewish people. He rescued them from slavery, brought them into a land to be their own. He was constantly faithfully working through them, raised up kings to lead them back to him. And all the while, Israel kept turning away, turning towards other places of guidance and instruction, turning towards other gods around them, not listening to the God who constantly was faithful to them throughout. And it gets to the point that God is going to allow them to be taken into exile. They're going to leave these homes that God has given to them so that they might see their dependence on him, so that they might turn and be faithful to him. But all along the while, God does not leave his people to just guess. Why is this happening? What is God doing? Did he abandon us? He raises up these prophets to speak truth during this time. One of these prophets was a man named Isaiah, who spoke of what God was doing during this time. All of it's happening, or at least the beginning portion is happening, under the reign of this king named Ahaz. And what we hear about for the purpose of the kings is that God's promise that he would raise up this line of kings that would last forever, and they would faithfully lead the people, that they would lead them back to God, not just care for the nation, but care about the yearnings that they have for God. And oftentimes you would see that the kings would be this picture of the faithfulness of Israel as a whole. If the king is faithful, the people tend to be faithful. If the king is reminding himself that God is provided everything that they have, well, the people would do the same. Ahaz was not that sort of king. He was an awful king. He thought that security came from his political wheelings and dealings. His ability to lead is what he thought it all came down to. He looked at how glorious the nation was and didn't realize how it became glorious from God working through them. He thought, well, I must be doing something right to get to this place. He even began to worship other gods, those who were from the nations around. And sometimes that would involve child sacrifice, which he was a willing participant of. He was an awful, awful king. And so for those who were faithful in Israel, or even us reading the story, it's hard not to go to, but God promised. God said what he would do. Why does it seem like that's not happening? God said what he would accomplish. Well, when is he going to get around to doing this? How long will we continue to wait? And the anticipation keeps building. Was a way to give encouragement. God told Isaiah that that this child would be born, this child of promise, to remind the people that God had not left them. God was going to keep his word. He said this child would be born and would be named Emmanuel, which means God with us. He says that this child will be a sign that I am with my people. I've not left. I'm not caught off guard. And there's an initial fulfillment of that. A child is born even to Isaiah's family, who is this reminder that God is with his people. But even that doesn't fully get to the extent of the promise. is still not 100% God with his people there with him. There's no pulling away. He's not feeling this closeness that, with him that was unprecedented. It's pointing to more. It's pointing to a greater need beyond Isaiah's day even. Well, that kicks off this whole process of Isaiah naming it the sons that are given to him as the way that God is working through his people. He has a son named Shir Jasheb, which means a remnant will return. It's the promise that God will bring some of his people back to this land, that he will continue to work through them. He has a son after that named Mahershala Hashbaz, which means the spoil speeds and the prey hastens. It's a really catchy name. I'm sure it was in consideration for you guys. But it's this idea that disaster is about to come for the Israelites. But it's this reminder that God's not caught off guard by this. This isn't an accident. God is using this to bring about faithfulness in his people. All along the while, Isaiah has these sons to tell the story that God is doing through the people. But it points to something further than that. It gives hope in his day, but it points to the greater need that we have to truly have God with us, to truly be joined to him. Something that the people are waiting for. Well, then we finally get to the promise of a son in Isaiah chapter 9, who will be this ruler, this king that God will raise up, that will be in stark contrast to Ahaz and be the exact ruler that the people so desperately need. Let me reread for us Isaiah 9, verses 1 and 2. It says, "But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone." I mean, just look at the promises of this son to be born, this king to be given, that this land that was marked by gloom and anguish will not be that way anymore, that this constant threat of invasion from the north, that's why it's talking about these northern tribes, this threat of coming from the Gentiles will no longer be there anymore. Instead, this ruler will come and the days will no longer be marked by darkness, but light instead. It will be marked by joy rather than hardship, abundance rather than lack, freedom rather than oppression, the end of all hostility rather than the constant continued trampling of conflict. It says that the government, that rulership will be on his shoulders, that he will be this king to come through and perfectly reign in the way that all people need, that will perfectly point the people back to God, that will perfectly not just care about the concerns of a nation, but be part of the answer of the spiritual crying out of every heart. This king that not just Israel needs, but the world needs, is promised here in Isaiah. "For to us a child has been born, a son has been given. He is this one that the world longs for." And so the anticipation builds. The waiting continues. And as you read through the book of Isaiah, it's, all right, when is this child going to come? When is he going to be born? When is God's people going to be brought back to him? And as you're reading through it, it's building this anticipation. The waiting becomes unbearable. And finally you read towards the end of the book of Isaiah, a son is born. This ruler raises up and then name him Hezekiah. And it seems like this must be him. He's leading the people so well. He's faithful. He's pointing people back to God. There's prosperity during his reign. Finally, our waiting has come to an end. Finally, the days of when will God keep his promises seems to be fulfilled. That is until Hezekiah too turns away from God. And the stopwatch starts again. When will God keep his promises? How long do we need to wait for this one that the world so desperately longs for? At all these places that we see, this must be it. Well, it falls short. Well, what a joy it is to be on this side of the cross and point to the day when this finally happened. See, what we celebrate at Advent is that Jesus has come. This promised child, the son who does exactly what we need, has arrived. It's no longer trying to figure out, is this king the one? Is this person here? How long do we need to wait? We can go to a definitive moment in time and say, that is when the waiting stopped. A child was born. A son was given. This king, this perfect one that the world so desperately longed for finally has arrived. So the way that we're going to spend Advent this year is we're going to look through these names that are given in the book of Isaiah to help us to understand who is this one who has come, to know how we can relate to him now, but also point ahead to what are we still longing for? What are we still waiting for the full completion of to happen? He has come. He has put in work that will certainly be fulfilled. And our hope, our encouragement comes from the fact that he has arrived. He will arrive again. So as we look at these names, as we see how do we relate to him, we see names like Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, Jesus. This one who is promised, that is who he is. This morning, I'm going to take that first name that's given from Isaiah chapter 9, and that is Wonderful Counselor. How is Jesus our Wonderful Counselor? Well, this idea of a counselor, especially in this government-type position, is being able to give guidance and direction for an entire people, to give encouragement to a nation as to what is to do that's best for their preservation, for their success. This giving of guidance on a national type level. But also with it, there comes this aspect of care and comfort that a counselor brings. And when we think about the world that we live in, there's so many places that try to fulfill this role of a counselor that gives us advice and guidance and direction, suggestions for how we are to live, ways to make things better in our lives. One of the key places that we get this is in commercials. There's all kinds of counsel as to your life is incomplete unless if you get this product. It's going to make things so much better for you. Or we can get counsel from friends, those who know us well and can speak into our life. Maybe we just got done getting a bunch of counsel at the Thanksgiving table as there was jabs from relatives at that time, hypothetically. Or one of the greatest places of counsel that we go to now comes in the form of reviews. Whether we're looking to buy something or just trying to find a place to eat, we are quick to go to what have other people said about this? Of course, we just filter it out by 5 stars or 1 stars. Everything else is just a waste of time. But we are quick to seek out counsel for everything. But it's not as though we're just victims of this, that everyone is just trying to tell us what to do. There's actually a part of us that really craves this guidance. There's a pastor in Kenya who had a quote that I just really liked. His name is Joshua Lemayan. He put it this way. He says, "Counsel abounds because crossroads abound. Our lives are full of gray areas, thin lines, and uncharted territories. Moments and seasons where the wisdom that we relied on previously will not suffice. To live in this life is to learn. Therefore, the question is not whether you have a counselor, but rather who it is." See, there's so much uncertainty. There's so much the fear around us that it's not just that people are trying to tell us what to do. We're desperate for that. We crave guidance. We crave counsel. Because without that information, without some sort of direction to go to, well, that's when insecurity comes. That's when anxiety takes over. I mean, how often do we feel or hear other people just say, "I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go." That so plagues people today. We are desperate for a counselor. And so that's what makes the promise of Isaiah 9 that this one who is to come, who is a wonderful counselor, is so beautiful, because that is exactly what we need. But Jesus did not just promise to be a wonderful counselor. As we go to the New Testament, we see he is that very counselor we so desperately need. I think of a place like Hebrews chapter 4, which is speaking of Jesus' unique role as our high priest, the one who mediates between us and God. As he does that, there's so much of it that's counsel that's given, guiding us back in the way that we need, giving us direction to go in life. So let me read Hebrews 4, 11 through 16, and we can see in this how Jesus is our wonderful counselor. It says this, "Let us therefore strive to enter that rest, so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience." Talking about Israel in the past. "For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and of spirit, of joints and of marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And no creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give an account. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. It's such a beautiful passage that speaks of who Jesus is for us. As we're looking at how do we relate to him, how do we know him, we see so much of how he is a counselor in this passage. A few different ways that I want to pull out as to how Jesus can counsel from this passage. The first one would be Jesus can counsel because he is wonderful. Going back to that language of Isaiah 9. When something is wonderful, it means it's tremendous. It's awe-inspiring. It's extraordinary. And it's that word in particular that I think captures this idea. It's extraordinary. It's beyond what we typically find on this world. It surpasses what we're used to being able to locate around us. And when we say Jesus is wonderful in this way, well, it's captured in this passage. Verse 14 speaks of how he's passed through the heavens. He is God himself. So by nature, he's something greater than what we typically find in this world. And so what that means is that the counsel that he can give will surpass anything else. We talk about how everything around us is trying to give us counsel. Well, here we have in Jesus one who is truly wonderful. Here we have is one whose word will be true and right. Here we have one who will be able to give us exactly what we need, guide us in the way to go, because he is wonderful. Think about how many times you and I have been given counsel, guidance, direction by other people, and it just falls apart. It's not what we needed. It just didn't work out. And that's not always because the other person is malicious, that they wanted to lead us astray. That's oftentimes not the case. They just don't have all the information, or they aren't able to give us exactly what we need in that time. Jesus as our counselor is wonderful. His guidance, his direction, his instruction is not like that. It will always be perfect. It will always be what we truly need. Jesus can counsel because his teaching is true. Verse 12 speaks of the character of God's word, what his message is, and it says that it's living and active. So it's not some dead words that we read from an ancient book, but something that continues to work in the lives of people today. That's why we open it up, not because we want to see what did God do back then, but know that God continues to work through his very word today. And it pierces to the very heart of a person. It gets to exactly what is true. So when Jesus gives his counsel, his teaching is true because he knows what is in a person's heart and their mind and what it is that that person needs. Third, Jesus can counsel because he knows us. Verse 13 says that nothing is hidden from God's sight. Verse 15 says that he is like us. He can sympathize in every way. That he's not cold or aloof, he's not distant or unapproachable. I mean, how often do we want to get advice from someone who doesn't seem to care about us at all? But Jesus isn't like that. He knows what we are like because he came to be with us. And then finally, Jesus can counsel because he gives us what we need. Let me reread verse 16 for us again. It says, "Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." I mean, such a beautiful promise. Let us draw near with confidence to God who gives us what we need, gives us mercy and grace. Because Jesus is our counselor, because he is the one who mediates between us and God, this one who gives guidance back to him, gives us advice and direction for life that's always perfect, that surpasses anything else that we could possibly find in this world. He gives us exactly what we need, the ability to confidently draw near to God, the ability to receive mercy and grace, the ability to get exactly what it is that we need. And I think this verse in particular, beyond being a beautiful promise of what Jesus accomplishes for us, well, it ties back to the situation of Isaiah. Because as I talked about, God's people were rebelling. They were turning away. And it gets to the point that it was dire. It was heartbreaking to see how God is speaking to his people who have abandoned him, who have turned away. And it gets to this point that we get to a really harrowing passage at the beginning of the book of Isaiah. Let me read Isaiah 1, verses 15 through 17. This is God speaking to Israel. He says, "When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourself, make yourself clean, remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Seek to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless, plead the widow's cause." I mean, this is horrifying to read. God says, "I will hide my eyes from you. I won't hear your prayers." That's awful to read. How do we get to this place? This is God speaking to the people he chose for himself, brought to this land, but they've rebelled so far against him that they look nothing like him. They've turned away from God to the point that they don't even seem near to him. The God whose eyes see everything, he is acting differently here. God made all of these promises to Israel, and as they're waiting for it, well, unfortunately, waiting has a way to reveal what we truly believe. And after all this time of waiting, Israel is making it clear that we don't think God will keep his promises. We're going to go somewhere else. We don't think God will do what he says he will do. We'll just take care of it ourselves. We don't think God is going to be faithful. So why should I be faithful? And it gets to this point to where he says, "I will hide my eyes from you." Now the question I have is, what changed? What changes from God saying this to Israel in Isaiah 1 to then saying later in Hebrews chapter 4 that we have the confidence to draw near to God himself? That we have the confidence to be joined in with him. I mean, even just sticking with Isaiah, Isaiah gets an opportunity to see the throne room of God and he's terrified. He trembles. He doesn't have confidence. He doesn't feel he could draw near. He says, "I am unclean. I am unworthy." How do we then get to Hebrews chapter 4 that says, you don't need to be like that? You don't need to hang back. You don't need to prove yourself to be worthy. You can draw near. I mean, especially when you think of how Israel is living in this time, and then I look at my life and I'm not always faithful. I have the capacity and to take advantage of that many times to turn towards other things. I'm much more likely to listen to my own counsel than anyone else's, and often that's not going to point me back to God. Like when I look at my life, I see much of the way that Israel lived in this time. So why is it that they're told God is hiding his eyes from them, but I am told I can draw near to the throne of God himself confidently? What changed? Well, a child was born. A son was given. The wonderful counselor came to this world on Christmas Day. His advent, his arrival, didn't just mark the end of waiting, but the flooding in of God keeping his promises. Where it's not the basis of my ability to clean my life up. It's not the ability of me to be faithful, but God faithfully kept his promises at Christmas. God faithfully came to this world to bring us back, to give us guidance back to him. God faithfully came as this wonderful counselor whose instruction and guidance surpasses all else that we would find in this world. And he alone is the one who points us back to the God that we so desperately need. This Advent season, like every single season of your life and my life, we're going to be given advice. Lots of instruction that's going to tell us what to do. It's going to pull our attention in different directions. Our calendar is going to get flooded. People are going to say, you need to spend money on these things. Everyone is going to try to tell you what this season is about. But what you actually need, it's already been given. A child has been born. A son has been given. Turn to him in this season. Listen to his guidance and direction now. because what we said about Israel was true. Waiting has a way to reveal what we truly believe. We are in a place where we can look back on Christmas and say, that stopwatch has stopped. The promises of God have been flooding in. We have hope to endure all that we have because we know for certain Jesus is coming back. But as we wait, as time passes, well, we could be like Israel and say, well, God's not going to keep his promise. God's not being faithful, so why should I? Or we can remind ourselves of the work that Jesus has done in the season, to not put us in the same footing that Israel had, but that we have the ability to be with our God, joined with him, guided back by his guidance and direction. Listen to him as your counselor in this season. As people in a world that's full of different messaging, different stories, different directions where to go, see that you have been given all that you need in this son who is born.